The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Camilla Sten. She joins us on the telephone in Austin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
You put out a novel recently called The Lost Village, and this is quite a novel. What made you write this?
Well, so The Lost Village is the first book I published in English, but I think it was my fifth book in Swedish. Uh-huh. And I was going through a spell of writer's block at the time. I was 24 when I wrote the first draft for this book, and I'd gotten it into my head that I wanted to write a great literary novel about life and death and everything in between. And of course, that did not go very well. It was very boring to write. And I was 24, so I didn't actually know a lot about life. So I had to scrap that project completely. And I was a little depressed over the fact that I hadn't managed to get that book to work out. And so I actually just gave myself The Lost Village as a fun project. I wasn't even sure I was going to publish it. I just wanted to write something just for myself, just because I enjoyed it. So it ended up being a book that incorporates a lot of my slightly weird personal interests, like ghost towns and cults and a little bit about mental health in there. And that ended up becoming The Lost Village.
So you've written four other novels in Sweden, and this one, you wrote it in Swedish and it was translated, or did you actually write it in English?
No, I wrote it in Swedish and
okay.
It was translated.
All right. Well, it's a haunting story, and I'm wondering about this village. Is such a place really exist?
No, Silvesjön, which is the way we would say it in Swedish, it lives entirely in my mind. But I've spent so much time there in going over the novel and doing edits that, to me, it feels very real. Sometimes I forget it doesn't exist. Okay. I think I have a perfect map of the town in my head. I could walk you around it.
Okay. So you have this village, and in 1959, the entire village, all the people in it except for a couple, mysteriously vanished, and no one knows where they went, and no one went back to this town to live there. They just left it abandoned.
Yeah. So the village in the Lost Village is one of the old Swedish mining towns. Sweden's always had a huge mining industry, but that particular mine in Silvesjön, that one kind of ran dry after a little bit. Mm. And so they shut in the beginning of the, of where the book really starts, the mine shuts down. And so basically the entire town, all 900 people are there because they have a connection to the mine. And when the mine shuts down, when they lose their job, they have nowhere to go. You know, there's no one who would buy any of the houses there because there's no point in living that far out in the countryside where there are no jobs. If there's no big industry. And so they're basically all stuck in this town. They have no money. They have nowhere to go. They can't sell their houses. They can't even scrounge up enough money to leave because it's so far outside of civilization, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. So they're basically trapped. And then a few months later, they all go missing, every single one.
Uh-huh. And you tell us the story through the present and the past. We have a series of flashbacks. It's mostly in the present, and we also have these letters that are scattered throughout the story by this young woman. And this documentary filmmaker has come to town. Her name is Alice Lindstedt. And she's kind of desperate, isn't she? She's looking to hit a home run, as we say in the United States.
Hit a home run. I love that. Yes, exactly. So Alice is approaching 30. And she was really our main character for the book. And she went to film school. She wanted to become a big-time documentary filmmaker. And it just hasn't worked out for her. she's gotten to see all her fellow graduates get big jobs and move on to big projects while she's stuck temping, taking up part-time jobs, just trying to do anything she can to get into the industry, and it hasn't worked out. And now this is kind of her last shot at her dream job. So she's gathered up a small crew of documentary filmmakers, a cameraman, a director, a friend of hers who's financing the movie, and she's managed to crowdfund enough resources to go up to Sidi Vishan and try to make a documentary about what happened to this town that she actually has a personal connection to. Her grandmother was from this town and lost her entire family when the entire population went missing. And so Alice has grown up hearing stories about this lost village, this ghost town. And this is the only chance she'll ever have both to make her dream project and to try to figure out what actually happened, to solve the mystery her grandmother left behind.
And I'm going to guess that this particular member of her crew, we really shouldn't say anything more about her connection, not Alice, but this other member, her connection to the village. That's kind of a secret, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a secret.
Okay.
She's not the only one who has ties to this town.
All right. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty intense. So as we start reading, we have this crew and they show up in this totally isolated place and they're checking it out and it's bizarre. Everything is frozen in time. People just left their cupboards full of food. They get to the point where they need food and they start actually scavenging food that's been sitting in the cupboards for many, many years. And then weird stuff starts happening. And that's when the reader starts to understand that Camilla Sten has written a horror novel.
Yeah, I just can't stay away from that horror genre. I think The Lost Village really is in large part inspired by all the old, worn-out Stephen King paperbacks I read as a teenager.
Oh.
You know, it's a perfect little town, and then one day something goes horribly wrong, and it's down to this small crew of people to try to figure out what happened and to save themselves before they get sucked into it. And I have to say, I've always been very fascinated with ghost towns. We don't really have them in Sweden. But I started reading about them a few years ago because, you know, there are ghost towns in Southern Europe and you have a few here in the States as well. And I've seen all these pictures of, you know, houses where there are half full coffee cups still standing out, where the laundry is still hanging outside the window. And it's such a fascinating image because you're looking at something that looks so familiar. You're looking at these houses that look like the houses that you grew up in. You're looking at these beautiful yards where it looks like children should be playing, but everything is just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the windows are cracked. The lawn is completely overgrown. But it still has this feel to it. Like any minute now, any moment, the person who lives here could walk back in after 60 years and just resume their life.
Mm-hmm.
It really does look haunted when you look at pictures from these places. And I couldn't help but start thinking when I started writing The Lost Village, if you took an environment like this and you started exploring it, wouldn't you constantly have that creeping feeling at the back of your neck that someone was watching you? Wouldn't you constantly be expecting the people who were once there to come back and ask what the hell you were doing in their living room?
Uh-huh. My guess is Camilla Sten. We're talking about her new novel, The Lost Village. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your source for public service journalism and music discovery. And the scenes that are set in the past when the village was still occupied by all these people, these are so haunting. We're watching as things are developing in the village, and there's a couple of characters that were just riveting to me as a reader. And one is a character named Birgitta, and the other is this minister who turns up. And these are really fascinating characters. How did you imagine these?
Well, if we start with Birgitta, Birgitta is a woman who is suffering from an, in the book, unnamed mental disability. I before I started writing books full time, I studied to be a psychologist for 3 years.
Oh.
And I've always found mental health, and especially the subject of women's mental health, to be a really fascinating subject. The way we have throughout history viewed women with mental health issues has often been radically different from the way we viewed men with mental health issues.
Mm.
Women with mental health issues have throughout history often been viewed as bad, as toxic, as evil, sometimes as possessed. And I wanted to try to realize that concept in Brigida, who is a person who needs a lot of help and assistance, and who is quite different. I have my own thoughts about actually what diagnosis Brigida would get today, but I intentionally did not include that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to view Brigida not as a symbol for a certain diagnosis, but just as a character in her own right. And just to try to fully realize the tragedy of Brigida, and that how this woman who has never hurt a living soul, who has never done anything wrong, who has been quite loved in her own way by the people around her, by her family, by her neighbors and friends, is made out to be the symbol of evil simply because she's a convenient scapegoat. And because in some ways she makes a convenient victim in this environment for the people who want to take advantage of her. I found her very difficult to write. I feel like as a writer, you usually get very, very invested in your characters. You grow to love them and care for them and think of them as almost real. And writing the way Brigida is treated by especially the minister, but also the people in the village, the more they succumb to what the minister is saying, was actually deeply painful. There's a scene towards the latter half of the novel that I put off writing it for a couple of weeks, I think. Because I wanted the scene to hurt the reader. Mm. I wanted the reader to feel how deeply wrong it was, but you really can't convey that unless you feel the pain yourself as the writer.
Yeah, there's almost something biblical about it. It's kind of
It's based on actual accounts of what's happened to women suffering these kind of mental disabilities and mental illness issues throughout history. This has happened, which just makes it worse. I actually had to tone it down a little bit because I think if I'd conveyed the full horror of what's happened to women like Brigida fairly recently, it would have been completely unreadable.
Well, thank you for your discretion. You're not going full bore on that. I think that your readers will appreciate that because we get the image, we get the picture. What happens?
Yeah. I feel like you have to treat your characters with a bit of respect.
Mm-hmm.
In portraying suffering, you have to remember that even though your characters are fictional, you know, people are going to relate to them in their own way. They're going to feel quite real to the reader. And I personally don't like books who just seem to take delight in human suffering.
Yeah.
That always feels slightly morally wrong to me. Because, again, you're describing fictional characters, but most of the time when you're describing suffering, it is going to be quite close to what some people reading a book might have actually experienced. You have to be a little bit aware of the kind of responsibility you have as the writer of a book that people are going to read. You have to take a little bit of responsibility for the emotional reaction some of your readers might have, and especially when you're dealing with a subject that's so fraught as mental illness, you have to take a little bit of care.
It's the Book Nook on WYSO, and I'll continue my conversation with Camilla Sten right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and today my guest is Camilla Sten. And as we look at history, we see so many examples of societies that were under stress, under pressure. This society in this village, they've lost their jobs, they don't know what they're going to do, and these types of societies, we need to look no further than Germany in 1932 to see how a leader can come and almost create a cult and lead people down a path that they maybe would not have wanted to go down if they were feeling comfortable and normal. And you have this woman who is taking care of Brigida, and she doesn't want to acknowledge what's going on in the village. Her husband's out of work. He's kind of a weak one. She's the strong one. And this is just really intense. You're into studies of cults, aren't you?
Is it that obvious? Yes.
Yeah.
I'm very, very interested. I'm interested in cults, but more than that, I think I'm interested in cult leaders. I find the more you read about cults, the more you realize that all strong men are the same. They use the same rhetoric. They use the same tactics to find a scapegoat. And they exploit people who are feeling desperate and lost. And I think that's a very human thing. I think every single one of us would be susceptible to falling victim to a cult if we were in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of us has at some point felt lost or desperate or lonely. And a cult offers a reprieve from that. It offers you communities. It offers you a context. And more than anything, it tells you everything is going to be okay. If you just do what we tell you, everything is going to be okay. You are going to be safe. Your loved ones are going to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Who wouldn't feel tempted by that?
True.
Especially in desperation. And so I wanted to make this village feel fully realized in that way. I wanted the people in it to feel normal and sympathetic. And you get to see the past timeline through the eyes of Elsa, who is my favorite character in the book. She's the goodest caretaker, and she's a middle-aged mom of two. And she's always been the kind of person who keeps the village together. She knows everyone. If you have a problem, she's the one you go to get some help. I think she kind of used the whole village as being her family.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that was the best way to really portray the horror of seeing this village fall under the spell of this minister, her being one of the few people who doesn't fall under that thrall, and see her try to do everything right and still seeing most of her efforts fail. Because she's a strong person, as you say. She's a powerful woman. And she's maybe the only person who could have saved this village from themselves.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes that's not enough.
Yes, we see things changing through Elsa's eyes and her concern for her friend Brigida. She takes Brigida's meals and looks in to make sure she's okay. Brigida lives in this house by herself. And Elsa really is a wonderful character. And is it, you pronounce it Aina? Aina?
Aina.
Is Aina Elsa's daughter then?
Yeah, Aina's Elsa's daughter.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't want to say too much about Aina, but she's the one writing the letters.
Yeah. She's a teenage girl stuck in this town where everything just seems to be going horribly wrong. She doesn't see a future. And then all of a sudden she gets this little spot of hope and light in the minister, who is young and attractive and seems to really see her. And I found Aina to be a fun character to write because I think, again, she's very much just a teenage girl. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that long ago that I was a teenage girl. And, I remember that feeling of feeling at once like the whole world is at your feet, but also feeling like you have no power in the world and no one is really seeing you and no one really cares about you or about your opinions or about who you are. And I think you feel very powerful as a teenager. You feel very smart. You feel very knowledgeable. You feel like you suddenly understand things you never understood before, and that paradoxically makes you very vulnerable.
I remember.
You get so high on that feeling of powerful.
Yeah, I remember. I was smarter than anybody else. Yep. Definitely.
Weren't we all?
Of course, I still am. No, I'm just kidding. My guest is Camilla Sten, and her novel is The Lost Village. And I've got to give it to you. When we get into the last, third of the story, you really ratchet it up. I mean, when we go full bore at the conclusion of the story, it is so intense and so incredible and imaginative. What a wild scenario you have created here. Totally unexpected.
Thank you. I think I wrote the last 25% of the book over the course of 3 days or something like that. I got so into it myself that I just couldn't put the computer down.
It just poured out of you.
When I'd written the final word, I fell asleep, and I think I slept for something like 16 hours. I was completely exhausted.
Oh, my. You mentioned that you've written these other books in Sweden. What kind of books are those?
They vary. I've written for kids. I've written for teenagers. I actually have a book, a young adult book, coming out in Swedish in a week now.
Uh-huh.
I've written some thrillers. Actually, the book I wrote after The Lost Village, The Resting Place, is going to come out in English next March, I think. Okay. Already available for pre-order.
Right. And is that on the same imprint, Minotaur?
Yes, it is.
Good for you. Well, I see they...
I know, no.
Yeah. I see that they published this first one was 100,000 copies, and, that shows a lot of confidence in you. I understand that you've got some movie or TV people sniffing around with this story. What, can you tell me about that at all?
Yeah, no, we sold the film rights to The Lost Village before it even came out in Swedish.
Really?
I think pre-production had to halt during the pandemic, but it's really exciting. It's absolutely wild. I know everyone says this, but I never could have imagined that The Lost Village would hit a nerve with people the way it apparently did. You know, this was just my little side project, and now it's going to become a movie. You never really imagine that when you're writing a book. I mean, you fantasize about it, but you never think it's going to come true.
Now, are you saying this is going to be a Swedish production?
I think a Swedish production bought the movie rights. I'm not quite sure yet what form the movie is going to take.
Okay.
It would be amazing if it was like a Swedish-American co-production, but we're hoping for that.
Well, these
then
things.
Then my boyfriend could watch it. That'd be nice.
These things take a while to develop, don't they?
Oh, they really do, especially when you have COVID running rampant throughout the world.
That's right. I was hoping to interview you a couple of months ago, and you just came to the U.S., so things must be getting a little better, huh?
Yeah, we finally managed to get to the States, but it took a while. There was a lot of admin that had to happen for me to be able to cross the border. But now I've been here for a week, so my jet lag is starting to ease up a little bit.
And what else are you up to? You say you have this book coming out any day, so clearly you're working on something else. What else is in the hopper, so to speak?
Well, right now I'm writing another thriller. Just started. I'm very much in the early stages of that one, so I'm a little nervous to talk about it.
Okay.
But it's a fun project. And I'm also working on working with the English translation of The Resting Place. They have a fantastic translator, Alexander Fleming, but I'm getting to tweak some things and give some notes, which is lovely. It's nice. It's the American translation is the first time I've been able to do that. When my books come out in Polish or Russian, there's really not much I can do.
So you can go through and correct the English a little bit.
I try to be careful. I don't think my English is quite so fluent that I can correct the grammar, but sometimes I can tweak a line and say, oh, you know, the way I phrased this in Swedish was actually a little bit harsher than it sounding in English, so we might want to switch this word out, or, you know, just getting the tone exactly right.
Uh-huh. Well, if I encountered you on the street and heard you speak, I would never guess that you were not American. I mean, you have the American, you have the American English down.
Thank you. I usually say I have a TV accent. I grew up watching a lot of American TV, so that's where I get my English pronunciation from. My British English teacher in school was heartbroken.
What American TV shows were you watching?
When I was growing up, this is such a cliche. I watched a lot of Friends, of course. I watched a lot of American crime shows, which probably checks out if you've read any of my books, and a lot of horror movies. Lot of horror movies. I remember watching Scream when I was way too young. I might have been 11 and just being transfixed by how scary and funny and great it was.
And you mentioned that you started off thinking you might be a psychologist. How did you transition into being a writer? How did you decide this is what you wanted to do?
Well, so my mother is a writer, and I've always wanted to write. And I published my first book in Swedish when I was 22, I think. And that was when I was at university. And I actually tried to keep my studies and my writing career going at the same time. And for a while, it worked. But then the writing started taking off. And I still had 2 years left of my master's program. And I had to make a choice. I was working 80, 90-hour weeks trying to keep up with both the writing and university. And in Sweden, the university is structured in the way where I was allowed to take an indefinite sabbatical, which felt nice. So if I ever do want to go back and get my certification as a psychologist, I'm allowed to come back and finish my studies. But, you know, getting to write full-time is such a dream job. I think I would have never forgiven myself if I hadn't taken that leap and seen if I could actually do this for a living.
Well, it sounds like you already knew that if your mother is a writer. Tell us about her. What kind of stuff does she write?
She writes crime novels. Vivica Sten, her work has also been translated. You can find her on Amazon. She would never have forgiven me if I hadn't mentioned that. No, she writes a Sweden-based crime series, and we have very different writing styles, which I think is good for our relationship, but her books are lovely. I think Agatha Christie meets the Swedish islands.
I'm going to have to look her up. That's Vivica?
Vivica. Yeah, like Vivica A. Fox.
Okay. Well, I've got to tell you, one of my all-time favorite crime series was Swedish, and it's the Martin Beck books.
Oh, no, you're kidding. That is such a Swedish classic.
I love those books.
I've read those.
Those are incredible.
Oh, they're amazing. They're an institution in Sweden.
Well, they should be everywhere.
That's the books that introduced me.
Those are so good. I try to turn people on to them. They wrote just those 10 books together, and then he died right after they published the last one.
No, it's such a tragedy. You know, Swedish writers do have a tendency to do that. I'm a little concerned. Stieg Larsson died after he finished his last Girl with a Dragon Tattoo book as well.
That's
so
true.
I'm going to have to wash my back.
That's true. Yeah. Well, you're young. How old are you?
I'm 28.
Wow, you're young. You got a long career ahead of you.
I hope so. I'll just have to make sure I never write a series and then write the final book. I'm going to have to stay away from that.
Okay. What's the last book you read that you really enjoyed?
It's actually a Swedish book, but it is quite well known here. Anxious People by Frederick Bachman.
Mm.
It was on the New York Times bestseller list for a while there, which I am very jealous of. But I went into the book with quite low expectations because I really, really like Frederick Bachman's work. And people had told me it wasn't as good as his previous books. And I read it, and now I don't understand how this isn't everyone's favorite book. Oh. It is such a beautiful story. It's funny, and it's poignant, and it's the kind of book that makes me just want to quit this business because I will never be able to produce anything of that quality. It's truly an experience.
Wow.
I wish everyone would read it. They should teach it in schools.
That's high praise. Frederick Bachman, huh?
Mm-hmm. Anxious People.
I have not read it. I'll have to track that down. Well, Camilla, it's been such a pleasure talking to you about your book.
It was so lovely getting to talk to you about it.
My guest has been Camilla Sten, her novel The Lost Village, just out on Minotaur, and maybe reaching the big screen someday. Watch out for it. And you heard about it on the Book Nook, and I hope to talk to you again sometime, Camilla. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's the Book Nook on WYSO, and we have a little extra time on the program for you this morning, and I'm going to bring you a special Book Nook bonus segment right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with a special bonus segment. 20 years ago, I did an interview with Bobby Ann Mason. She's a writer from Kentucky. She's made a number of appearances on the program, And when I spoke to her back in 2001, we were talking about her story collection called Zigzagging Down a Wild Trail. I had always heard that the New Yorker was a very tough magazine to get into, and then when they accepted your piece, they would really edit it and really slice it up, and a lot of very well-known writers endured that because they wanted to be in the New Yorker. What was your experience?
Sure, that's true. Well, I did get a lot of rigorous editorial attention, and being a novice, I could use a lot of editorial attention. I wouldn't say that it was sliced up and rewritten or anything like that. It was mostly really small stuff, like the commas.
Oh, punctuation.
Yeah, and clarity. In my first published story called Offerings, there was, in the editing of that, there was a line where Sandra told the dog to go to his bed while she did something or other. And the query in the margin was, where is the dog's bed? And I didn't know. It was where the dog's bed is. The dog's bed is where the dog's bed is. And my editor told me that it would trip up readers to have this floating dog bed that we couldn't visualize and place. So that's an example. That's the one I always think of first.
The floating dog bed. I can see them doing that. I really can. My guest is Bobbi Ann Mason, and she joins us to talk about her new collection of short stories. It's called Zigzagging Down a Wild Trail, just published by Random House. And we also have a new paperback published by the Modern Library, which is a division of Random House, of her early collection of short stories, Shiloh and Other Stories. Now, is anything different about this edition of Shiloh? Are these exactly the way they were?
These are the same, yes.
I love it when you refer to music. Like, you talk about putting on a Kinks album. Mm-hmm. You talk about songs that they're listening to on the radio. Mm-hmm. Music's been a big part of your life, hasn't it?
Sure. I always listened to music all my life.
Especially those Hilltoppers, huh?
The Hilltoppers, they were a pop group in the early 50s. Well, all through the 50s.
Weren't you the president of their fan club?
I was the president of their fan club in Mayfield, Kentucky. And I had many joyful hours listening to the Hilltoppers and actually traveling with my mother to hear them perform.
Do you still keep in touch with any of them?
There are two of them still alive, and I do keep in touch with them. Yeah.
That's really great. You were a teenager when you fell for them.
Yeah. And they were very nice guys, and I fell for them because they were from Kentucky. And I thought they made the most wonderful music. And for that time, they were really, really one of the superior groups. They were quite famous for a couple of years.
And they wore like the matching suits. And didn't your mom arrange to get them some suits or offer to get
them? She worked at a clothing factory. And the president of the factory was a country boy who'd worked his way up to be president of the factory. And so he got along with all his employees in a very country folksy way. And she said, well, Willie will give them some suits. And she just marched to the president of the factory and got them some tailor-made suits with the Tony Martin label. Tony Martin was another popular singer. So, I mean, things like that.
We see so much great writing coming out of the South. Last week I had a guy on named Robert Morgan, who's got a book called This Rock. He's from the Carolinas.
North Carolina.
I love his stuff. The South, it seems to be changing. I don't live there. It's just my perception. It's getting more built up, more developed. The countryside is starting to get impinged on by all the housing. Do you see any changes in the South that you know and that you remember?
I'm now traveling around in the South. Everywhere I've been in the last few years, you just see construction of those McMansions, the huge houses, housing developments. And so the landscape is changing. There's an older generation, I guess my mother's generation and a little younger, that is dying out. So there's a whole memory of a rural culture that is dying away. But I don't know, the writers of the South and the artists seem to be determined to preserve some kind of uniqueness of the Southern culture, even as it's changing.
It seems like every time I turn around, I run into another great Southern writer. And as far as regionalism goes, I can't really think of another area of the country that can even compare.
No, of course not. not since New England in the 19th century.
Back when Emerson and Thoreau and
Melville and mm-hmm. Hawthorne, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The story where the woman is throwing pots and the little boys come into her yard.
Yeah, she's not throwing pots at them. She's at a pottery wheel.
There's that New York editor again.
Right.
This story, I really felt like a voyeur when I was reading this story. I felt like the neighbor who was getting so upset about what these kids were doing. Mm-hmm. This woman's detachment from her own reality.
Mary, the woman who's doing the pots.
Uh-huh.
The neighbors trying to tell her what to do, and the kids are trying to take advantage of her.
Uh-huh.
And she's trying to use, what, she's detached, you think?
Well, these kids are just running wild in her yard, and she's upset about it initially, but then she sort of enables them. And then the ending is almost surreal.
Well, it kind of kicks her back in her mind to a place she hadn't wanted to think about, just a memory, and a memory of a lost romance. And so they're riding the three-wheeler, her three-wheeler. They've gotten out of the garage, and they're driving it like mad all over the place. And she talks them into letting her show them how it's done. And she takes off. But she tells them it's like the scene in E.T., and they think she's a witch, so that uh-huh. explains that some of why you said it's surreal.
I guess it took me back to my own experiences as a little boy mm-hmm. and having neighbors and trying to understand them and mm-hmm. communicate with them. And I had this belief that I had a right to go into anybody's yard in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. And don't they swarm around and say, oh, you've got a neat clubhouse, and it's her pottery studio.
Your stories have such an amazing ability to make me think and to reconnect with forgotten memories in my own life.
Really?
Yeah. I thank you for that.
Oh. Well, I guess maybe in part that's what I'm trying to do in writing them. I'm just grabbing at little snatches of memory, and then like a bird building a nest, I've got these little pieces of bright, shiny things and sticks and soup.
And when we're stumbling through the woods and we see that abandoned nest in the tree, we recognize the beauty. And the bird that wove it was just creating something that they needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, abandoned it.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting. Yeah, but I'm trying to say that I make the nest. That building a nest is analogous to building the short story. You just take all this stuff. And then what do you have left? I don't know, an abandoned nest.
Maybe with a couple of beautiful
object.
Maybe a couple of beautiful eggshells still in the nest.
Yeah, well, like the bowerbird who builds a bower to attract the female.
I don't know the bowerbird.
Oh,
bird.
The bowerbird. Well, the bowerbird builds these extravagant, beautiful structures out of whatever he can find to be pretty, to attract this very dull-looking female.
Are they in Kentucky?
More like New Guinea.
Oh, okay. Was it damson plums that I learned about from you?
Oh, you don't know damson plums?
I've never had one. I hear they make a pretty good pie, though.
They make a terrific pie because they're not plumped full of tasteless juice the way modern plums are. They're old-fashioned. They're small. They don't have a lot of juice. They're very, very tart and flavorful.
What's next for you, Bobby Ann? Are you working on any new books?
Well, at present, I'm trying to finish up a book. It's not fiction. It's a book for the Penguin Lives series of biographies. And my book is about Elvis Presley.
Really?
Yeah. And
how fun.
The other books in this series are about distinguished figures like Jane Austen and St. Augustine and Charles Dickens,
I know
Robert
the series.
E. Lee.
It's a wonderful series.
So Elvis is a major figure in this series of historical people.
Now, how did you get the opportunity to do that? Did they call you?
I was asked by the editor, yeah.
Now, is this the editor that just left and went to Random House?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
What editor?
I know, Penguin Putnam, the woman just left and went to Random House.
Oh, no.
Somebody who's actually an editor who's not, not like running a publishing house. What's your take on Elvis?
Well, I've been reading about Elvis for months now and reading everything I can. And I'm writing a biography of him, Elvis the person, not Elvis the icon. And Elvis the person is an awfully sad story. And so full of dreams, which makes it sad that his dreams turned into such a nightmare. But he is thoroughly fascinating. He never gets boring. He was very complicated and fun to be around in this project.
He loved his mother.
He certainly did love his mother.
And when she died, he was changed by that a lot, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was all he could do to keep from going to pieces. But he did. But it did change his outlook. Everybody always says that he lost his moral compass. But he was also liberated from her, and she was quite strict.
Well, we'll look for that.
Well, good.
Bobby Ann Mason writing, would you call it a biography?
Elvis Presley.
Of Elvis Presley.
Oh, would I call it a biography?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay. And that's for the Penguin Lives series?
Yes, it's short biographies, so it's not like the huge two-volume biography that came out a few years ago.
With Reckless Love and
Careless Love.
Careless Love,
and Last
sure.
Train to Memphis right. by Peter Guralnick.
I had him on for that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Wonderful biographies, yeah.
The thing with Elvis, he's like certain other people, Marilyn Monroe comes to mind. When you see a photo of this guy, there's just something that comes out of the photo.
Yes. I've spent a lot of time just looking at the pictures and imagining myself into his psyche. Or you can tell from different periods looking at the pictures what he was going through.
And that was your Book Nook bonus segment with Bobby Ann Mason, recorded 20 years ago, talking about her story collection, Zigzagging Down a Wild Trail. And last month, we lost Arnold Adolph, who made several appearances on this program, and really just an amazing guy. And I want to share his obituary that was published in Publishers Weekly recently. Children's poet, author, and anthologist Arnold Adolph, widely noted for his inventive poetry style and for depicting African-American experiences in his work, died on May 7th, at his home in Yellow Springs, following a brief illness. He was 85. Adolf was born on July 16th, 1935, in New York City, and grew up in the South Bronx, where his Jewish parents, who immigrated from Russia, had settled. Adolf's father was a pharmacist whose store was just a block away from the family home, in what Adolf described in a Something About the Author interview as a mixed working-class neighborhood. Adolf's recollections of childhood include a house that was filled with magazines and newspapers, music from his mother's violin playing in the radio, and lots of passionate discussions that he characterized as volatile, emotional, as well as intellectual. He credits his parents and grandparents for passing on to him the way they valued of their Jewish heritage and liberal causes, and prized the roles of women in society. As a teenager, Adolf began reading widely and started to write poetry. His love for music continued to grow, and by age 16, he was sneaking into jazz clubs all over New York City to see such legends as Sarah Vaughan, Dizzy Gillespie, and Charlie Parker perform. Following high school, Adolf enrolled in Columbia University School of Pharmacy with a goal of following in his father's footsteps, but the program didn't suit him, and he became so upset that he ran away from home to Chicago. His stay in the Windy City was brief, however, and after he called home, his parents urged him to return, assuring him that they supported his study of anything he wanted. Back in New York, Adolf followed the emotional pull of poetry and politics and enrolled at City College, where he majored in history and minored in literature with plans to become a history professor and a poet. While at City College, he wrote for the school's newspaper and literary magazine and served as president of the jazz club. The latter afforded him the opportunity to meet jazz bassist and composer Charles Mingus, whom Adolf called his spiritual father. After abandoning his history studies in favor of becoming a writer, he rented an apartment in Greenwich Village and supported himself with a day job, substitute teaching, while he continued writing poetry and frequenting jazz clubs at night. In this period, he became Mingus's manager. It was Mingus who introduced Adolf to a young writer and occasional nightclub singer named Virginia Hamilton. The couple married in 1960 and would welcome two children, daughter Lee and son Jamie. Adolf began collecting black literature in the late 1950s, and that pursuit dovetailed with his observation that the ethnically diverse students in his classroom were exposed to racist textbooks and didn't have access to books and magazines that accurately reflected their experiences. Wanting to address that, he shared his favorite poems and works by black writers with the kids. Once, Adolf recruited a friend and editor at Macmillan to make photocopies of some poems so he could distribute them to his class. The friend was impressed by the selections and suggested Adolf meet with the editor-in-chief about turning them into a book. The result was his first anthology, I Am the Darker Brother, an anthology of modern poems by Negro Americans, published by Macmillan in 1968. Arnold was a trailblazer. This obituary closes with an amazing tribute from his longtime editor, also Virginia Hamilton's editor. Her name is Bonnie Verberg, and she writes, Arnold Adolf was a love letter. His poetry was lighter than the finest French pastry. And at the same time, his words could cut into me with a sharpness that drew blood. I have never known a man who loved his wife more than he loved Virginia. I will eternally be thankful for his unwavering commitment to stand up for equal rights, even in the face of impossible odds. He inspired and encouraged generations of writers and enhanced the lives of children and their older allies, as he would put it. I am forever in his debt. Wow, what a tribute. Arnold, we'll miss you. And I'm putting together a special memorial show using one of the interviews that we did with Arnold over the years, and that'll be coming up on a future edition of this program. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And we have hundreds of Book Nook interviews you can listen to anytime you want at wyso.org in our Book Nook archive.